Blog Talk Radio.
Paperback writer.
This is the Writer's Lounge, where we showcase new authors. I am your host, Tom Riedel, and this is show number 94, and the date is July 26, 2021. And a brief intro to today's show, we will have on at 15 minutes after the hour, Gary Friedman, who wrote Stones and Glass Houses. And that's the brief intro, and now more about us. Here's where you can find us out there. Find us on Facebook, The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. Find the book reviews of all of our current shows over at thomasriedel.net. That's thomasriedel.net in the blog section. And the on-demand radio shows can be found there on the podcast page as well. Or go over to the Blog Talk Radio site and search for The Writer's Lounge. Find me on Twitter at TomRiedel56, and our email is writerslounge2020@yahoo.com. If you want to be a guest on the show and have your book reviewed, put guest request in the subject line and we'll get back to you. Special note, we can also now be heard on your Alexa device. Subscribe to TuneIn and ask her to play The Writer's Lounge, showcasing new authors. I'd also like to put in a plug for Goodreads and Reezy Discovery. They both do a great job to help authors and readers alike, and I also review books on both of those sites as well. That wraps up the show intro, and now on to the next topic of our show, which is writers' topics. And what I'd like to talk to you about today is that when writers finally decide to sit down and write a book, they have most likely devoured all kinds of advice as to how to write the next best-selling novel. One of the biggest pieces of advice I and others have heard is to show, don't tell. I've often wondered, what exactly does that mean? When we start writing a narrative to a story, how do we present it, and what's it mean to show? Well, in the clip I'm about to play from Diane Callahan, which you can find the full version on YouTube under How to Show, Not Tell, she explains with several examples of what showing and not telling means. It's about 10 minutes long, and after that, we'll be back to chat with author Gary Friedman. Stay with us.
The girl was scared of the wilderness, her heart pounding at every frightening noise. But suddenly her fear disappeared. She touched the ground, and it felt like her new guardian. What's wrong with this picture? Well, for one, this passage doesn't actually paint much of a picture, and it fails to make me feel anything as a reader. That's the core problem with writing that relies too much on telling. We're told the girl is scared, that the noises are frightening, and that this place feels like a guardian. Yet there isn't much evidence to back up those claims. Show, don't tell is a phrase you've probably heard often in the writing community. Author K.M. Weiland best captures the distinction. Showing dramatizes, telling summarizes. But it can be hard to identify harmful instances of telling in your own writing. Telling is not inherently bad. In fact, all novels are a blend of telling and showing. You don't always need to show instead of tell. If that were the case, all stories would be ridiculously long and filled with unnecessary descriptions. Telling is useful for quickly conveying the passage of time or presenting important facts to the reader without belaboring the point. Take a look at the opening of the children's novel, The Secret Garden, by Frances Hodgson Burnett. When Mary Lennox was sent to Misselthwaite Manor to live with her uncle, everybody said she was the most disagreeable-looking child ever seen. It was true, too. She had a little thin face and a little thin body, thin light hair and a sour expression. Her hair was yellow, and her face was yellow, because she had been born in India and had always been ill in one way or another.
We're told some information about Mary being a disagreeable-looking child who's always been ill, but that statement is immediately supported by the visual proof of her thin face and hair, along with her sour expression. If someone flags your writing for too much telling, that likely means you need to provide details or a strong narrative voice to make the reader feel something. Good writing invites the reader to visualize the scene and experience the emotions themselves, rather than being told how to feel. In his TED Talk, The Clues to a Great Story, Pixar writer and director Andrew Stanton proposes the unifying theory of 2+2. He says, make the audience put things together. Don't give them four, give them 2+2. The opening of
Mary
relies entirely on showing the audience the equation without giving them the answer, and he describes why that approach is effective.
Storytelling without dialogue, it's the purest form of cinematic storytelling. It's the most inclusive approach you can take. It confirms something I really had a hunch on, is that the audience actually wants to work for their meal. They just don't want to know that they're doing that. That's your job as a storyteller, is to hide the fact that you're making them work for their meal. We're born problem solvers. We're compelled to deduce and to deduct, because that's what we do in real life. It's this well-organized absence of information that draws us in. There's a reason that we're all attracted to an infant or a puppy. It's not just that they're damn cute. It's because they can't completely express what they're thinking and what their intentions are. And it's like a magnet. We can't stop ourselves from wanting to complete the sentence and fill it in.
The same principle is true for other non-visual modes of storytelling. The key to making your audience care in fiction is to imply your meaning, rather than always pointing it out. Readers love the process of discovery and solving puzzles. Before we dive into some practical strategies, I want to take a two-minute detour to explore the origins of Show, Don't Tell as a writing mantra, since it's not often discussed. In his 2004 book, Creative Writing and the New Humanities, scholar Paul Dawson describes how the novel transformed across the 19th and 20th centuries with the rise of realism as a literary movement. Realism aims to tell the stories of ordinary people with complete honesty rather than romanticizing them. Dawson notes, from Flaubert onwards, the trajectory of the novel is often regarded as the development of techniques to impersonalize the narrator in order to efface the presence of the implied author and dramatize as much of the action as possible. Literary critic Percy Lubbock praised those 19th century realists for giving the novel a defined aesthetic, and it's his 1921 book, The Craft of Fiction, that likely popularized the idea of showing versus telling. He says, the art of fiction does not begin until the novelist thinks of his story as a matter to be shown, to be so exhibited that it will tell itself. Authors like Virginia Woolf both praised and criticized Lubbock for confining the novel writing craft to a formal system.
His ideas were incredibly influential in the literary world. Basically, the intention of this advice is to turn the author into an invisible narrator and avoid breaking the reader's immersion in the story. Janice Hardy makes a similar observation in her 2016 writing guide, Understanding Show, Don't Tell. A common rule of thumb, as long as it feels like the character is thinking it, you're usually okay. But as soon as it sounds like the author butting in to explain things, you've probably fallen into telling. If you want readers to experience the story's emotions on a gut level, you've got to know when to show. Generally speaking, moments involving emotions, opinions, or sensations are best shown rather than told. Here are 6 guiding principles for a stronger showing. Number 1, use evidence to support your claims. If a narrator says her husband is a kind-hearted person, or the protagonist believes his best friend is guilty of murder, what led them to that conclusion? Give the reader the same evidence the character uses when it comes to assumptions or opinions. Author Chuck Pumpernickel advises a ban on thought verbs like thinks, knows, understands, realizes, believes, wants, remembers, and imagines. He talks about unpacking scenes so that the reader feels and thinks what the characters are feeling and thinking. He gives this example. Instead of saying, Adam knew Gwen liked him, you'll have to say, between classes, Gwen was always leaned on his locker when he'd go to open it. She'd roll her eyes and shove off of one foot, leaving a black heel mark on the painted metal, but she also loved the smell of her perfume. The combination lock would still be warm from her ass, and the next break, Gwen would be leaned there again. Polonik adds, instead of characters knowing anything, you must now present the details that allow the reader to know them. Instead of a character wanting something, you must now describe the thing so that the reader wants it. You can pull readers into the story by presenting evidence, whether that's a visual detail or a piece of dialogue, and letting them come to their own conclusions about the impression you're trying to create. Number 2, replace the abstract with the concrete. In particular, be careful about directly stating a character's feelings. The blog Novel Writing Help by Harvey Chapman gives a great before and after example. Telling, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby walked home feeling happier than he'd ever felt in all his 13 years. Showing, after his first kiss with Samantha, Toby couldn't keep the goofy grin off his face all the way home. When he came to the front gate, he jumped clean over it, didn't come close to tripping. Chapman further explains why the changes work. Happiness is an abstract concept and needs to be demonstrated, shown, not told, with concrete details, like the wide grin and the gate jumping. So you can often replace emotions with actions that allow the reader to infer the emotion. Also be wary of descriptions that use opinion-related adjectives, like beautiful or strange. In a first draft, I might write, the dark forest felt eerie. Okay, maybe it feels eerie to the character, but the reader needs to feel it too. I need to convince the reader that it's eerie using evidence. The forest hummed as the cries of children long dead. That's better. Sufficiently eerie. Replace adjective labels with details that allow the reader to interpret the atmosphere on their own. A trick for identifying when you're in abstract territory is to ask a question that Jeff Gert poses in his book, The First 50 Pages. Can the camera see it? Almost all examples of showing contain a detail that can be visualized, although you'll often want to combine those visuals with smell, touch, taste, and sound. Author Jerry Jenkins provides great examples of replacing abstract emotions with concrete actions on his blog. Cold, don't tell me, show me. Your character pulls her collar up, tightens her scarf, shoves her hands deep into her pockets, turns her face away from the biting wind. Tired? He can yawn, groan, stretch. His eyes can look puffy. His shoulders could slump. Another character might say, didn't you sleep last night? You look shot. Another way of thinking about this camera idea is to consider the effect and not the cause of a particular detail. Take a look at these additional examples from Jerry Jenkins. Telling, the temperature fell and the ice reflected the sun. Showing, Bill's nose burned in the frigid air and he squinted against the sun reflecting off the street. Telling, Susie was blind. Showing, Susie felt for the bench with a white cane. Telling, it was late fall. Showing, leaves crunched beneath his feet. In the first example, the cold temperature is the cause of specific effects on the character, namely Bill's nose burning in the frigid air. Instead of being stated outright, the details are instead shown through how the character interacts with the world around them, like leaves crunching beneath their feet, which makes the scene more visual.
Well, there you go. I hope you enjoyed that little clip. Again, that's Diane Callahan. You can find her over on YouTube. Just look up Show Don't Tell, and that's where you can find the rest of that episode. I think it's probably closer to 20 minutes than the 10 minutes that I played here. But now on to the main event, and our guest author today, of course, is Gary Friedman. And I'd like to remind everybody, if you're listening to the show live, you can call in with the phone number at 914-219-0868. Once again, it's area code 914-219-0868. And now I'd like to talk to you about Gary's book called Stones and Glass Houses by Gary Friedman. And the Amazon synopsis goes like this. The interaction where truth collides with deception takes place in a hospital emergency room as revealed in Stones and Glass Houses. After 30 years of loneliness and excuses, two families are set free by the piercing alarm on a flatline monitor. As the trial of deceit unravels, five lives change forever, all because of the arrogance and weakness of a man who claimed to love them. Gary Friedman weaves a riveting tale that offers a bird's eye view into the complexity of human and love that jumps off every turn page. How will they move on from the mangled heap of lies? And in my review, I wrote, in reading the first pages of this book, it was difficult to follow where the author was trying to take me. He told the story in the first person of several of the characters, and the dialogue seemed disjointed from any formation of a plot, but it finally took form after a few chapters. At that point, the tale gripped me and kept me glued to the pages. In catastrophic, emotionally wrenching, life-changing event, two families are brought together, strangers now tied together with a common thread that has been there unknown to them for three decades. Gary Friedman has given us a story that should reinforce the importance of understanding our humanity and how each of us navigates life and how we learn both the beauty and the ugliness that is out there. Love the book and look forward to more from Mr. Friedman. And now let's try it again after some glitches. We will bring on to the show with a click of a button. Mr. Friedman, can you hear me?
I can actually hear you, Tom.
Very good. And now I'd like to get into asking you some questions here. First of all, you're just west of me in Buffalo, is that correct?
That's true.
How's things out in Buffalo today?
It's actually sunny today. We've had a pretty good week.
Very good. Yeah, we're not doing bad here ourselves, and hopefully the summer continues the way it's been going. We've been a little bit wet, but other than that, it's been great. From doing my research on you, I see you have authored at least half a dozen books with a series known as the Shepherd Chronicles, and also you are a public speaker. Can you tell us more about that, more about you, and what inspired you to become a writer?
Well, Tom, it's something that kind of hung around in the background for me for a long time, and as I started to approach what was going to be my retirement from the working world, I said I wanted to do something more. I wanted to make a difference. And the book, the Shepherd Chronicle series, was just that. It was a story about making a difference and how one person can change the world. And I enjoyed writing it, and it kind of led to a degree to Stones and Glass Houses as the message carries forward from those books to this one.
Uh-huh. And how did you get your start early in life as far as your interest in writing?
I should have, but I didn't. It's a sad story in a way. My very first day in college, I had a 25-year professor in English assign a paper to a bunch of freshmen. We all turned them in Wednesday morning, and Friday he turned all the papers back out and said, and I didn't get one, so I was a little concerned what happened to my paper, and he said, now I'm going to read you the best paper I've had in 25 years of teaching.
Oh.
And that sort of knocked me on the head and said, you need to do this, but 18 years old went right over my head, and I forgot about it until many years later.
And that's interesting because I have a very similar story. I didn't go to college until the mid-90s, and I'm around your age. So if you can get an idea, I was probably middle 30s, and I turned in a paper to a professor, and he called me after class and told me to come up to the front. And I felt like I was a kid again back in high school, and he told me he hadn't seen anything like that since. He says, I was doing graduate-level work, and it was maybe my second month in college. So we share a similarity there in our writing, and it's been quite the journey for you with what you've been doing here, and I really, really liked your story. In Stones and Glass Houses, you chose to tell much of the story in a first-person narrative, which at first I had trouble with, as I mentioned in my review. But then you hooked me with it in telling a very dramatic story about the lives of these people who lived in a virtual roller coaster of a life. Now, why did you go with the first person, and do you have any regrets in this literary approach?
Really, none at all. I mean, I really enjoyed the process. It required me to kind of get directly into the head of all six of the major characters and to kind of perceive what they were thinking and feeling at that moment. And there were a lot of head-turning moments throughout this book that I actually had the same scene described three different ways from three different people's view. And I think that was important. I think that the reader got an extra boost out of finding out what the character was actually thinking in his own words at each moment.
Yeah, because as we talked about in the beginning of the show, they talked about show, don't tell. And I think sometimes we get into a narrative of a story, we, as authors, tell the story of what the character is going through, but you just jumped right ahead and had the character tell the story, which again was something I had to get used to in your story. But once you did that, I saw exactly what you're trying to do. What a better way to get in touch with somebody's feelings and, like you say, get right into their head. So I applaud you for that. You turned the corner on me a little bit there and surprised me a bit, but it all worked out in the end.
Well, I think if you look at a scene like occurred in the emergency room, to see that scene and how it affected each individual subject in that emergency room at the time, you got a totally different view of what was happening and how it affected each one of them. And the heart of the story is how each individual was affected throughout the book.
Do you have any background in medical experience?
No, I'm a certified counselor and so I have a little bit in terms of the way people think and the way they respond. The medical stuff, I got a little bit of help from people along the way, but no real medical history.
That was, you described that very well. And again, with the way you did it with first person, it felt like you were actually right there. And that's what I think authors have to create with their stories, is to bring the reader right into the scene, and you accomplished that very well. Aside from fiction, this story has been played out in some form in real life for many families. What's your message to families who may suspect that they're being deceived in some way by another family member? You mentioned you are a counselor, correct?
Right. I think that the message of the book, if there is an overall message really in all the things that I write, is that the message in the book can change the lives of readers if they come to know that they're in control of their own destiny. In each one of these characters, they acted within themselves and made choices. And we're in charge of those choices. We're in charge of our success. We're in charge of our failure. And the good news is you get a chance to choose, so you're in control of your life. And in each case, at one point or another, each character came to grips with where they were in life and where they were headed and what they had to do to get to the final goal. All of my books deal with people at a crossroads and which way are they going to go? Are they going to run towards success or are they going to run towards failure? And in many of the cases of the characters in my earlier books, the choices were unexpected. And I kind of hoped this was too.
Are you a family counselor?
No, actually, my earliest counseling work was drug and alcohol rehabilitation. But then I went into the high schools and did some work in high schools.
Okay. And you did have a character in your book, and I don't want to give away too much here, that had some alcohol problems. And
yep.
Did you base that character on some of your experiences as a counselor?
I think my experience of being around people in recovery and what they've had to do to get there led in large part not only to the character's actions, but her son's also, who kind of followed her along the way. So, yeah, I think a lot of that was back to my basics.
Right. And it's a very admirable profession that you chose to go into. I imagine that you've had some probably sleepless nights after listening to some of the stories that you hear throughout the day. Is that correct?
You hear some pretty horrible things, but the things that you hang on to, I still have a letter that was written to me probably 30 years ago from a client who told me I saved their life, and that's the kind of thing you keep to the day you go. And you hang your hat on that, knowing that you've made a difference. And that's the basis of all my books.
Right.
Making that
very
difference.
Good. Yes. And I want to remind everybody once again here, if you're listening live, hopefully they're not on the other link from the one we had at 7 p.m. It didn't quite work out right. But if you are listening live, you can call the show and talk to Gary at 914-219-0868. Don't be shy. I know a lot of you out there listen, and some of you listen on the demand shows after the show is over. But I would encourage you to pick up that phone and give us a call and talk to Gary about his book or about his writing life. And I'd like to ask you, Gary, how long did it take for you to write Stones and Glass Houses?
Well, the original process, I'm sort of a pantser, if you're familiar with the term. I'm a stellar storyteller. I don't sweat the sentence or sweat the words. It took me about 9 months to write the basic story. And then it was from that point forward, you know, all the editing that goes with it and all the fun work.
Right. So it was 9 months, and I imagine you probably did quite a few drafts, correct?
I'm not really. I kind of go through the whole book and write the whole book, and then I kind of go back and start over again and see where it's taken me and if there are any things. But really, no. Once I put the story down, I turn it over to an editor, and then we play with it.
Okay. And earlier you had mentioned something about research. How extensively do you research the content in your novels? And has what you learned changed any of the direction of the plots as you go along in the story?
I think that not necessarily. A little bit along the way, I kind of have the story in my head as I start to write it from the beginning. I don't write out outlines. I don't go with that direction. I just know the direction I want to take the story, and I tell it. I didn't do a whole lot of research in this book. Some of the things I knew... You write what you know, and from that point of view, most of my books start in Buffalo, New York, and go from there. This particular book takes place in all of Western New York and never really leaves. So I'm familiar with the areas. I'm familiar with the parks and the streets and where everybody was going. And it was just a matter of personal drive, who was doing what and the decisions they made. The actual research was in questions about the medical aspect of it and how to take that, which direction to take it.
Uh-huh. Can you tell us a little bit more about the other books that you've written? Is it a sequel or prequel to this one, or is it separate?
It's totally separate. The characters are totally different. The trilogy is a story about a young man named David who starts out in life kind of struggling, not really knowing the direction he wants to go in. He decides to go off to Nashville to become a country music singer and fails miserably, comes back home, and gets in a critical car accident after making up with his family and coming back to grips with his life. And on his deathbed, he makes a promise, which is the name of the first book, The Promise. And that promise is basically, don't let me die. I got too much I want to accomplish and too much I want to do. I'll serve you in any way you want me to serve you, God, but please don't let me die. And he goes through a miraculous recovery in the hospital, and the day he checks out, he's visited by a mysterious messenger who says, okay, you made a promise, time to keep it. And David kind of goes out on the road and just wanders interacting with people, helping people find their way back to their path, and in the process finds his own. I tell people it's sort of a cross between, if you remember the old show, Kung Fu.
Yes.
I can't remember the other one at this moment, but he kind of wanders the road and ends up coming back home and ends up finding out who he is and encourages other people to go out and change people's lives. That the true measure of a man isn't the size of their house or the number of bathrooms in their house or the amount of money in their bank account. It's the number of lives you touch in a positive way. That's the score that's kept in heaven and nothing else. So it's reaching out and helping people and being there for them. And that's what the whole trilogy was about. It's his journey through three books.
Kind of reminds me a little bit with Highway to Heaven. Remember that show with Michael Landon?
That was the other name. You got it. That was the other show I was going to mention, Highway to Heaven. Yeah, it's a kind of a combination between the two. David makes a difference. And the subtitle to the first book is Can One Man Make a Difference? And David proves it. And he starts out just himself, and by the time he's done, hundreds of thousands of people are following him on social media, and he's known around the world by the time he finishes. So it was also a fun story to write also.
And I think when you look at, a series like Highway to Heaven, you kind of get a pretty good idea of what viewers like to watch. And sometimes that's a good source to go to if you're, an aspiring writer. You can look at some of those series to see what people are interested in, and then kind of plug yourself into some sort of a storyline that goes along those kind of ways. But I definitely got to read the rest of your books and see where they take me. And
when I was really young, Tom, I knew I wanted to write a journey book. I fell in love with The Hobbit and J.R. Tolkien's writings, and I just wanted to write a journey, and David takes a three-book journey that was fun to write.
Right. Good. So did you change anything in your writing style from Stones and Glass Houses to the trilogy?
The whole story, the trilogy, was told through David's eyes for the most part. The Stones and Glass Houses book is told through the eyes of each of the major characters in the book and the decisions they make and the way they handle their life and the way they handle their crossroads. And a lot of people have said to me, tell me more about Jesse. I want to know more about Jesse. And he was basically the liar. And I've had a lot of people encouraging me to write a story about just Jesse, get before sort of a prequel to Stones and Glass Houses. So that might still happen.
Right. That was another thing that I picked up on that I didn't mention in my review. I'd like to know more about him. And I thought maybe you did that. You left that question open purposely for a prequel or a sequel to that story.
Well, I didn't do it purposely, but might end up that way. Like I said, a lot of the people that read it early on said, how did Jesse get away with this? What made him do this? And He was a deep character that didn't get a lot of inspection, so it may be coming.
So you're a fairly young author at all this. How do you feel about book reviews?
Wow. First of all, I appreciate yours. I appreciate the people that make a life out of it or a hobby out of it nonetheless. My issue is it's hard to get people to write reviews. It's hard to get people to go to Amazon or any other site and write a review. It's like pulling teeth, to be honest with you. And it's difficult. I really think you have to have sort of what we called it a book brigade going in, of people who are on your side going in and were beta readers and read your book beforehand, and hopefully they'll have reviews ready for you when you launch. And I think that's the best way to start getting reviews, but it's very difficult after launch to find people to write reviews for you.
I think what's more important, I've been told, is the amount of reviews, before maybe a publisher or an agent would pick you up, as opposed to the quality of the review. In other words, either a 1-star or a 5-star. And I've noticed, you know, sometimes someone will give you a 1-star review and they've never even finished a book. And that, quite frankly, pisses me off, because how can you review something you haven't completed? And that happens a lot. Just wondering, have you got any bad reviews at all from Stones and Glass Houses?
Thankfully, no. I really haven't. They've all been pretty positive. Sure would like to get more of them, but they've all been pretty positive. And I don't know how I'd react to a bad one. I'd have to ask somebody else how they've handled it. But, you know, you try and be objective and realize where someone's coming from. And as you said, maybe they didn't read the whole book, or maybe they just didn't get it, and maybe the book didn't speak to them. And that's not as much my fault as theirs. I can't reach everybody. You can't write a book that's going to reach everybody the same way. It's trying to identify who your readers are and trying to reach out to them and get them to read it.
Yes, and I've also experienced the same problems with my book. I wrote a book, and it's only gotten, I think, 6 reviews, and they've all been 5 stars. But I can't get anybody else to go there and leave a review. And then sometimes what happens is Amazon will take down a review if they find out that the person writing the review is connected in some way to you as a friend or a family member. So there's that aspect of reviewing that's very difficult to get a review. Once again, it's the quantity of the reviews. I've been told that if you get 25 or 30 reviews, it's great. People will start to pay attention. Anything less than that, you really don't get a lot of recognition from the big boys,
right,
such as the agents and all that. So it's a very frustrating thing for a self-published author to do. And even now with, even now with the traditional publishers, they do not do a lot of marketing. That is left up usually to the author for the most extent.
Absolutely. And I didn't get into this to be a marketer, although, you know, I had some experience in it, but it's definitely the tough part of it. I love the writing aspect of it. And then once you're done writing, then the hard work comes. Then you really got to do things that maybe are not in your comfort zone. It just depends on what you want to do with your book and whose hands you want to get it into. And they're not going to come knocking on your door. You got to go to them.
Right. Where do you see your writing going from here, say, in 5 or 10 years?
Well, as I said, I've had this thought in my head about Jesse and his story. We all have dreams of being picked up by a big publisher and getting published in that regard. And maybe someday that'll happen if I actually get an agent to reply. It's just a matter of keep doing what I enjoy doing. I'm not doing it for the money. I'm not in it for the money. It's putting the story in the hands of people whose lives it can change. And if I change a few lives along the way, then I'm a pretty rich man.
That's a great way.
You know, if people read my books and find that I've pointed out something to them that they didn't realize or remembered something they'd forgotten about their life and who they wanted to be, then I'm pretty successful.
That's a great way to look at it. A lot of people don't, but it's a matter of getting out there and doing something for somebody, whether it's entertaining them through just a regular old novel type story, or if there's something in that novel or story that causes to change somebody for the better. That's a wonderful thing we can do. And like you say, it isn't all money. Did you give a lot of thought to, you have self-published, but where did you go to self-publish?
Well, my first 3 books, the trilogy, all went through Lulu. And that was, as you said, they promised to do a lot of marketing and really did nothing. So I decided this time I was going to go through Amazon, and I've not exactly been thrilled with their work. So I'm going to get lucky one of these days and find the right guy who's going to help me put a book together.
Right.
Amazon was a big letdown.
Yeah, I've also gone through Lulu, and I've just had them do my you know, print the book, and the quality has been wonderful. I've been very happy with the quality of their book. I've never heard of anybody telling me that they would market it or do anything else for me over there. But I guess there's options you can go to a lot of these publishers. Even Readzy Discovery has formatters and editors over there that will help you with a book. And, you know, the editors are there too. So
okay.
I guess, you know, there's a lot out there for us to digest. And I started doing this 10 years ago. And it's sometimes very frustrating to find out what direction you want to go. And once you get there, you're either satisfied or you're not until the next book comes out and you got to do it all over again. So it's very difficult. But being retired, do you miss the work you did? And other than writing, how do you spend your time?
No, I don't miss it at all. I'm busier now than I was when I was working. I'm a vice chair for SCORE here in Buffalo. And we kind of give back our business experience to help other people start their businesses as volunteers. And I'm also a chairman of a board at a YMCA locally. And we're doing a lot of work for helping people and a lot of work for serving others, trying to help with, you know, the homeless and helping with Feed More, Western New York, which is like a food pantry. So I've been very active in the community and following through on David and making a difference.
Uh-huh. Very good. Sounds like David is sort of your niche.
Well, people have asked me if I'm David, and I said, well, he's considerably younger than me, but I think his heart is my heart. I think it takes you a while. Someone's got to slap you in the side of the head to make you realize the advantages and the chances you have in life to help other people. And David certainly got slapped. And I wish I had gotten slapped earlier, but I think his heart is my heart.
And who are some of your favorite authors and why?
Well, the one that got me to the point of really wanting to write was probably, I read a lot of Gresham and I read a lot of Baldacci and I read a lot of Michael Conley, but I think it was Mitch Albom. And the stories that he's told in some of his books. The last book I read before I wrote my first book was, your brain goes first when you retire. I think it was Magic Strings. Remember that part, you'll find the book. But I think that Mitch Albom tells stories of people and the roles they face in life. And I think I enjoyed his books and wanted to do something like that. So he's probably my favorite author.
Mm-hmm. And you have a favorite movie?
It's a pretty old one. In fact, it was such a favorite movie of mine, To Kill a Mockingbird, that when it went to Broadway, almost three years ago now, I went to Broadway and saw Jeff Daniels play the role of Atticus Finch, and easily my favorite play, my favorite movie of all time.
Very good. And you are currently working on, is it number four? Well, which book are you working on right now, currently?
I'm still in the marketing stage for Stones. I haven't started writing. Maybe in September I might start writing another book. That's my plan at this point. But I'm still in the marketing phase. And as you said, when you self-publish, it's you and nobody else. So you can't do them both. So that's where I'm at right now with my career. So I'm trying to do that. And then hopefully by September, right after Labor Day, I can start my next book.
All righty. And any other parting words that you would like to share? We're getting down to the end of the show here. And what would you like to say to aspiring writers or anyone of thousands of readers out there?
I think the best advice I can give you is set some time apart in the day and make that your writing time and just sit down and write. No one's going to do it for you. You're not going to learn by reading somebody else or watching somebody else. You've just got to do it. So if you want to be a writer, write.
And where do you go to write? What's your favorite place?
Well, I've had some different places, but unfortunately, through this pandemic, most of those places have closed.
Right.
So I have my own office in my house, and I do right there, but there's some places like Panera's or coffee houses, or Tim Hortons here in Buffalo, where I'll go just to get away, and for some reason I can tone out what's going on around me and just write. The entire second book I wrote was written at a Panera's, so you do what you got to do.
Do you enjoy people watching?
Oh, I do, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely a people watcher, and I think you get things from watching people, and if you absorb them and hold on to them, they come back out of you in a character somewhere down the road. No, I kind of, well, if it's, as I said, the first thing that goes to your brain, but I've always had a good memory, and things just kind of stick with me, and I see that in the character, I see that in a story, or something comes back to me from earlier in a life. There's a character in my very first book that was from my early counseling days that came back to me, and I was touched to be able to include him in the book, but I'm not saying which one he was. I think things, you watch things. If you're an observer of people, an observer of life, you're halfway to being a good writer.
And that's absolutely true. Where would people find you other than Google out there if they would like to contact you or buy any one of your many books out there?
Well, all my books are on most of the major sites, either Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Apple. I have my own website, GaryFriedmanBooks.com. All my books are available there. You can also email me there or get on my email list. And if you're ever looking for speakers, either in New York or somewhere in the near side of that, that you're looking for someone to come to speak to your organization or your church or your group, I'm available. Love to speak and love to talk to groups.
Very good. Gary, it's been a pleasure. Sorry for the technical difficulties earlier on. And I really enjoyed having you on the show. You are show number 94. And we're getting close to that 100th show mark. We got an anniversary coming up here of 10 years in August, and I'm glad you're a part of it. And I'd welcome you back at some point. And as a neighbor to my west, I would say it's good to be in your company, and I wish you nothing but success in everything that you do.
Well, thank you very much, Tom, and I appreciate the opportunity. And if you're ever in Buffalo, give me a buzz, and we'll have a cup of coffee.
I will. That sounds
something
great.
Something stronger.
Here. Take care.
Okay.
Now. Yep.
Thank
bye
you.
Bye-bye. And there goes Gary Friedman again. His book is Stones and Glass Houses, and you, of course, can find that anywhere where books are sold. And so this comes now to the end of the program where we discuss what's called the final chapter. Isn't that appropriate for a Blog Talk Radio writing show? That would be it. So on our next show, which would be Monday, August 9th, 2021 at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we're going to have on author Dave Moore. And he has written a book called, and you know what? I didn't put it down here, and I'm going to have to look again. I made a mistake here. But anyways, more about Dave, I can tell you, is that since his childhood, Dave Moore wanted to fly. Nothing else mattered much to him. And during his early 20s, his dream came true. He soon became a flight instructor for Ohio University while he was still a student, but unlike some who breeze along the zenith of their dreams, fate would send Dave on a turbulent ride through life, and it all started when a deer ran into his plane during takeoff at an Ohio airport. After he and the student pilot crashed into a wooded area, Dave pulled himself and his unconscious partner out of the woods, crawling for over 2 hours before he reached help. With his face literally torn off and other injuries sustained in the crash, he spent weeks in recovery, but as a tribute to his determination and his lifelong dreams, he was back in the air 45 days later. And this book, which is coming up with Dave, isn't all about the horrific airplane accident. It's about surviving and thriving even when something like a deer collides into you or another obstacle stands in your way and causes your life to seemingly crash into oblivion. And with that, I'd like to say, see you next time on the Writer's Lounge, where we will let the story begin. Enjoy yourselves and be well.
If they asked me, I could write a book about the way you walk and whisper and look. I could write a preface on how we met, so the world would never forget. And the simple secret of the plot, it's just to tell you that I love you a lot. Then the world discovers, as my book ends, how to make